Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Athletic Support, your podcast on the Montreal Canadiens by TheAthletic.com. I am Marc-Antoine Gallin on this beautiful Monday, March the 6th, and I'm with Arpin Basu. Hello, Arpin. How are you today?
I am good. I'm good. I should tell our listeners that we're actually recording this on March the 5th. Marc-Antoine is in Las Vegas, where the Canadiens just finished, what was kind of a perfect game for them, where they come back and they put up a fight in the third period, but ultimately come out of it with no standings points. So yeah. they've had three games in a row like that, more or less. So really, well done, Canadians. you're following the script that I think everyone wants them to follow, well.
Absolutely. Now you just told them, our listeners, all the sausages and ate. I just said that it's a beautiful day. I don't even know if it's going to be a beautiful day on Monday, but who knows?
It's true, but who cares? I mean, listen, it's very late on Sunday night. I mean, the reason we're recording this on Sunday night is Marc-Antoine is going to be traveling all day Monday. But in any case, it's fresh, and this is fresh after the Canadiens' last game, and the trade deadline has passed. Not only for the Canadiens, but for all the teams. And I think one of the interesting things about the trade deadline passing now is you can look at the standings and you know what each team is. So, which teams have been gutted. And there was kind of this concern that if the Canadiens are unable to get rid of enough pieces, everyone else is going to get much weaker. And really, that hasn't really been the case. I mean, look at the team directly behind the Canadiens in the standings, the Vancouver Canucks. I mean, they lose, obviously Borovat a while ago, but, they trade away Luke Shen, but then they go ahead and acquire Philip Ronick. And so ultimately they didn't get much weaker. Arizona traded a couple of guys, obviously, some big pieces, but, Chychrun hadn't been in the lineup for weeks. Otherwise.
Well, they lost Bjugstad and Gostisbehere.
They lose Bjugstad and Gostisbehere.
They're probably the team that lost the most during the deadline.
Yeah, probably. Really, I look at the Coyotes very much the way I look at the Canadiens, and I feel like they have taken on the personality of their coach, and they compete. Listen, they took the Devils to overtime, what will be last night for our listeners, but tonight for us at home. Mm. So collected a point against a pretty tough opponent. Timo Meier was playing his first game, scored his first goal in a Devils uniform. The Ducks lose, Klingberg. Not much else. So they pretty much are what they are. Obviously, the Sharks lost Meier but kept Carlson. Didn't really make many significant moves. It's set. The Canadiens are actually in a decent spot in terms of trying to move down. Not trying to move down, but might move down the standings as a result of how the deadline played out. But we did want to start with a bit more of a deadline recap. We had a podcast in French on Friday, obviously. But, watching some of the reaction from some of the fan base about how the Canadiens handled the trade deadline, which was obviously quite quiet. We had tried to warn you for weeks that it was looking like it was going to be pretty quiet for the Canadiens. And yet I still felt not an overwhelming sense of disappointment, but definitely a lot of people who were upset that Ken Hughes wasn't able to, sort of monetize or liquidate more players at the deadline. Have you caught that? And if you have, what is your reaction to that? Because I find it a little surprising.
Yeah, it's like the I saw a comment from one of our readers who said, "I'm glad that there are some reporters out there who are calling out Kent Hughes for not doing enough at the trade deadline." And honestly, I wonder what those people expect when you look around the league. I mean, a guy like Jonathan Drouin was a prime candidate to be traded at the deadline prior to the season, depending on how his season would go. He did not generate any sort of interest. And I draw a parallel between his situation And James Van Riemsdyk, who stayed in Philly, Van Riemsdyk makes more money than Drouin. He's slightly more productive. But it's two situations where teams, even if they were to retain 50% on their salary, what you're asking the other team to absorb in terms of money, it better be worth it. And the number of teams that actually had that sort of buffer, had that sort of money, and were willing to integrate that sort of player, they would probably have to find a third team as a broker to finalize the deal. And then you have to give an asset to a third deal. It becomes very complicated and in that situation, guys lose their value. So that's why the Flyers end up staying put with Van Riemsdyk, who's still against all odds. He's still in Philly. It's less surprising, I think, with Jonathan Drouin, because what we were hearing for the past few weeks was that the phone was just not ringing for him. But apart from him, you look at other guys, you know, that were not rental players and guys with contracts. Yes, Edmondson, if it was not for his back, he would most likely would have been dealt. But what people consider like dead wood here, guys like, I'm thinking first and foremost about Mike Hoffman. You say, oh, the guy's no good, trade him. Well, if you think that the guy's no good, why would you expect that another team would take on that contract? Everybody is looking to get rid of their bad contracts, but there's just no money in the system to even sweeten the pot and manage to find ways to sell those bad contracts and make it worthwhile for your team. I'm not surprised that nobody, you know, went for Hoffman. You want to give up Dvorak? You want to give up Jake Allen, guys that are very serviceable? Is it going to really make your team better in the short terms? I don't know. It depends on the sort of offer, if there was any, for either of those guys. Depends on the sort of offer that they got. But to expect that, to say that doing nothing is the worst outcome would be wrong, because staying put and you know, not moving certain guys is probably the better outcome compared to what it might have cost in certain cases to get rid of those guys.
Yeah, well, first of all, you have to maintain a certain standard of what you will accept as a return. Like, it's one thing, you know, your point is extremely valid. There needs to be a demand. So I think you look at a player like Christian Dvorak, for instance. I'm sure if Ken Hughes asked around, sure, some teams might be interested in acquiring a Christian Dvorak. I don't think they'd be bending over backwards and doing backflips that he was available, but he's a useful center, checks a lot of boxes. Maybe, you know, maybe they, but what would the return be? Like, what would, you know, and compare that return to how much it actually helps the process, right? I mean, if you're looking at third, fourth round pick, you know, I mean, something like a middling prospect, like, or a package centered around pieces like that, does that really advance the rebuild that much? Yes, it sheds salary for sure, but they do need to ice a team. They do want to actually be somewhat competitive. They're already decimated as it is right now. So if you remove, like, I mean, you talk about Hoffman. You know, the demand is just not there. Listen, and I was told that the Canadiens might have even been willing to retain money on him, including next year. And it's not feasible. And so then, if you have to start adding sweeteners to get rid of guys, then you have to start looking at what's the alternative. And the alternative in Hoffman's case, if they want to consider shedding some money, they could shed basically 2/3 of his cap hit. By buying him out. And if you bought him out on June 15th, it would be 1.66 against the cap for the next 2 years, as opposed to the 4 or 5 that he would cost next year. So these are all sorts of alternatives, but I mean, these are all things that will come up in the offseason, and players are going to get traded this offseason. It's just a fact. Like, it's just the market conditions around the trade deadline. And again, we tried to warn you all about this, but it's the amount of money that was tied up, the Canadiens injury situation. And if you want to harp on the injury situation, be my guest, you know, and we've done it lots on the podcast, and I don't know if we're going to get, I don't know to what extent we're going to get into it here again, but it's a fact that Joel Edmondson not being healthy, Sean Monahan not being healthy, took Kent Hughes' top two card. Like he wasn't flush with players that teams are dying to add. You know, those are the two guys. I think if Drouin was able to have a more consistent season, I think he's played well since he came back from injury. And I think he actually had some teams at least considering the possibility. But as you mentioned, and same with JVR, a team has to look at Jonathan Drouin and say, okay, are we gonna create the space necessary, the $2.75 million prorated, obviously, but $2.75 million that it would take to add Drouin, considering the question marks surrounding his game, it's not realistic. And then when you talked about the third-party broker, the thing you have to keep in mind is that it's only useful having a third-party broker if the player you're trading is worth more than the price of brokering the trade. And I'll explain what that means. Basically, if you were to trade Drouin, in a best-case scenario, you'd be offered a third or fourth round pick. That's basically the cost that you'd have to pay a broker to broker the deal. Third to fifth round pick is generally what it costs. I think the Coyotes got a third round pick in 2025, if I'm not mistaken, for the Patrick Kane deal. That was like the best brokering price that moved at this deadline. Most of the time it was a fourth or fifth round pick. The Canadiens picked up a fifth round pick in the Bonino deal. So if you're paying more for the deal to be brokered than the actual cost of the player that's being traded,
defeats the purpose.
It defeats the purpose, and it's just it's not going to make for a brokering deal where the team is paying, and it's not the team that's trading the player away that's paying the broker. It's usually the team acquiring the player that's trading the that's paying the broker. So you're saying, okay, Canadians, I'm going to give you a fourth round pick to get this player, but Team X, I'll give you a third round pick just so you can help me get that player that I only think is worth a fourth. That doesn't really work. So I just don't, you know, I understand the disappointment. Listen, Ken Hughes was disappointed. When he got up in front of us on Friday, I think it was Kenzie Lalonde of TSN, at one point after 25 minutes or so of answering questions about doing nothing, Kenzie actually asked a great question. Like, you satisfied? He's like, no, I'm not satisfied. Like, I would have loved to have been able to do something. He tried, but he's not swimming in healthy players that other teams want. There's not a lot of them. There weren't any, really, as it turns out. But, you know, the two guys that might have generated some interest, injuries got in the way. And that's kind of outside Ken Hughes' control to some extent. But it is something that Ken Hughes and his front office needs to look at in this offseason.
One thing, because we mentioned Dvorak or Allen, for that matter, or other guys, there might be a better market for certain players around the draft, because at this time of the year, it's only the competitive teams, the playoff bound teams, that are buying. Whereas unless you're doing a retool on the fly, like the Washington Capitals and the St. Louis Blues have been trying to do.
And apparently the Vancouver Canucks. Who knew?
Who knew? Yeah. They don't. I think they don't know what they're doing.
They do. No one who follows their team understands what they're doing. But
anyway. But yeah. So my point is that, you know, come around draft time, when there will be contracts expiring, a definitive number on what the cap will be next year, everybody becomes a potential buyer. So then you can look at more teams that could be attracted by player XYZ. So this is something to, because it's not a finite, you can say, oh, trade deadline and there's no life after a trade deadline. Well, it's always a very evolving, continuing process. So after the trade deadline, well, on to the next date, the next target, and, you know, they'll try to make their moves at that point. But in the meantime, the Canadiens, I've been icing a team in Vegas that was, you know, full of American League players. There was one more with Frédéric Allard, the defenseman that was recently added, and it was in because of the Caden Gooley injury. And up front, after a bit of line shuffling, Martin Saint-Louis came up with a line made of Jonathan Drouin, Mike Hoffman, and Josh Anderson. And those three guys played a little bit together earlier in the season. But in the light of this trade deadline, when you have a guy that was, you know, that was of the three the most likely to leave in Drouin, and the chances were not high. But I mean, he was, let's say that he's on the tail end of his tenure in Montreal. You have a guy that probably we can assume that management would like to get rid of in Hoffman, and Anderson, who at this point is probably their best trading chip. You put those three guys together, and it makes for a very odd trio, very odd line, because in the light of, you know, post deadline trade deadline hockey.
You could call them the I guess the no future line. It's not really fair for Anderson, but I mean, it really is, to varying degrees, three guys that seem to be on their way out. Listen, Jonathan Drouin wasn't traded. I think it had to be a bit of a disappointment to him that no team was willing to take him at half price. I think he might have welcomed it. He does have a modified no trade clause on his contract with only a three team no trade list, so I don't think that was much of a factor. So, you know, his future to me is fascinating. I think a team should try to sign him, and obviously at a much lower salary, but give him sort of a show me contract. I think he could actually thrive in a different environment, sort of rejuvenate his career. Mike Hoffman, you know, we've gone over it. Yeah, you just nailed it. I think it's fair to assume at this point that the management would like to find a way to get him off the club. Again, against Vegas, I mean, they're trying to like mount a comeback to tie the game, and they have all this momentum, and then he has the puck in his own zone, and he throws like a backhand pass through his own slot to no one in particular, like not a really, and it gets picked off. It almost turns into a scoring chance, and you're like, you're literally the oldest guy in the lineup. I mean, you are the oldest guy in the lineup. You are the guy who should not be doing things like that, and you continuously do things like that. So I think every time he does something like that, Canadiens management just looks and just like, we can't get this guy away from our young players soon enough. So I don't know if they're willing to buy him out. I don't know what kind of a trade market they could find for him, but I think he's maybe playing his final games in the Canadiens uniform one way or another. And then there's Josh. And Josh, what I find interesting about the Anderson situation is, you know, you mentioned how everything's connected and how it's a cycle. Like a lot of the trades we see at the draft originate out of conversations that happen ahead of the deadline.
Yes, that's true.
And that's like the trades that you couldn't make at the deadline that you talked about. Those discussions pick up at the general manager's meetings, which happen next week in Florida, and extend into the draft. So like that meeting, those meetings in Florida that Ken Hughes will be attending, I would imagine that a lot of the things that he was proposing to teams that they just couldn't do, those conversations are going to pick up again, because, you know, I personally feel that the closer you get to the moment where the cap goes up is when Josh Anderson becomes most likely to go, which would be the next trade deadline. But it's always a possibility that a team's going to look at any team that was looking at maybe adding him at this deadline, but just couldn't find a way to do it. Because obviously there's going to be no money retention there. Even not the 4% that Matthias Ekholm got from Nashville, because there's another 4 years left on Anderson's contract after this one. But I'm going to be really curious to see if there's something that Ken Hughes can do to acquire draft capital / prospects / something for a guy who's been very highly sought after. But I think one thing that should be made clear is that Ken Hughes likes Josh Anderson a lot, like as a player, you know? I mean, not, you know, he likes him as a person too. I think he's a pretty widely liked guy just as a human being, but him on the ice, the unique aspect of him, the package, even though it doesn't result in tons of goals all the time, but I think what scouts see in Josh Anderson, what makes other teams interested in him, I think also interests Ken Hughes. So I think that's going to be a really fascinating aspect of the offseason is do any of the talks or any of the pitches, you know, Ken Hughes kept saying, I keep getting calls on Josh Anderson kind of thing, or he keeps kept bringing that up. I think those calls might get a little bit more serious, maybe as soon as next week at the general manager's meetings.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure I agree with you when you say that he's on his way out. I think that it's a possibility. Logically, when you look at the fact that, you know, the progression curve of the team and his age, the number of years he's got left on his contract, and the fact that his most effective years as a player, he's likely to spend them on a team that's not competitive yet. It would sound logical to move him at this point while he's still healthy and young-ish, or not yet in his 30s at least. But for all logical that it might sound like, I'm just not sure that it's going to happen. You know, who knows?
I think it'll happen by the deadline of next. That's what I'm saying. Is that.
By next trade deadline. Yeah, yeah.
At some point between the draft and the trade deadline, I think he'll move.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
In that sense, that's what I mean. He's on his way out, like not imminently, but
no.
You know, I don't think by the time this team is competitive, I don't think Josh Anderson's going to be on it. So, that's what I meant. I don't think everyone, but it's going to be interesting to see if that can happen this offseason, because I do think there would be interest in turning him into draft capital for this draft as opposed to the next draft. So if they can get a high enough pick thrown into whatever package they would accept for Josh Anderson, if that means adding a late first, I don't know what return would be, but I think it would take a significant return to get the Canadiens to move him, which is why I would agree with you, it's probably going to be unlikely, but I would be surprised if there weren't talks prior to the draft. That would surprise me.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
But then again, I mean, you have... trades that have been done prior to the trade deadline where a lot of first round picks were traded. And traditionally, teams that get those picks in a trade, they will hold on to them and use them at the draft. But this year, it seems as though there are teams that have been, well, we made a joke about Vancouver and referencing to Washington and St. Louis, but it seems like there are some teams that are trying to walk the line between remaining competitive and while at the same time doing a bit of a makeover of their roster. So you're getting rid of your rental players, of guys that might not make sense on your roster at this time, at this specific time. You get draft capital for them, but who's to say that they're not going to use that draft capital at the draft and say, well, we've got this guy who's under contract for 4 more years. He's the type of guy that fits, you know, our identity or what we want to be. And even though we just acquired a late first round pick, well, we can use it on acquiring that sort of a player like Josh Anderson now. So because I feel like there's a shift in the mentalities and the way that teams go about their business. So taking that into consideration, even though it may be more likely that we're going to have to wait another year before Josh Anderson is traded, we cannot discount the possibility that that it might happen at the draft too.
The one reason being is that the one dynamic that exists at the draft that doesn't exist at the trade deadline is that you have teams, and we saw this with Marc Bergevin. When Bergevin traded Lars Eller for essentially Andrew Shaw, it wasn't obviously directly, but basically traded Lars Eller for Andrew Shaw, that was a reaction to what he had just seen his team do in the playoffs. And that was a reaction to what he felt his team needed to get through the playoffs. And so you have general managers who do that, who have their playoff run, what they just witnessed from their group, realizing what they're missing. And I'm going to guess that there's going to be some teams that are going to get knocked out of the playoffs early. We're going to be, man, we really needed some more size and speed, ideally all in one. And we could have used a guy like that. Yep. That could have made the difference between us being out in the first round and making the conference finals. So that's the one dynamic that is unique to the draft trading period, is that you have all these GMs who are still butthurt over what their team did in the playoffs, has still have it fresh in their mind what element their team is missing, and will be hyper aggressive to go add that element at that juncture. So that's the one area where there might be a bit of an advantage for the Canadians, is that if there is a team out there who, and frankly, any team that has gone through a playoff series would probably look at a player like Josh Anderson and say, we could have used a guy like that. Whether the price is right, or whether the whatever the fit is right, or the stylistic fit, or there's all sorts of variables that go into it, but it's you know, and the problem with for the Canadians also is that the further away you get from playoff Josh Anderson being fresh in a general manager's mind, the less the perceived value of him is. You know, I mean, now it's been 2 years since we haven't seen Josh Anderson play in the playoffs. That memory becomes more distant. He becomes that much older. So that's just,
yeah, that's, but the size and speed about. The combo of size and speed has not gone away.
No, it's still there. That's what I'm saying. So that's why I find this going into this draft with him to be so interesting, because I'm convinced the Canadians will not trade him they will trade him for a significant package. And if they don't get a significant package, they just won't trade him. But that's why I find it so intriguing, is that there's going to be, after the first round, eight teams will be out. There'll be eight general managers who are going to be racking their brain for 2 months, thinking, why did that happen? What could I have done differently? What could I have added to allow us to get past that? And I wouldn't be surprised if some of them looked around at the players that might be available and looked at Josh Anderson and been like, that could have been that guy.
Yeah, absolutely. And so maybe we have to look at the Stanley Cup contenders, those who have a lot of money that's going to come out of the books at the end of this season, and who might not have been able to fit him, you know, in a longer perspective right about now because they were so tight against the cap. But if a lot of money goes out July 1st, then he might become an option.
Yeah, that too. But I mean, the beauty of the draft is that the picks being the currency is, once that passes, although that's also changed. That used to be the case where if you didn't get a trade done by the draft, you kind of had to wait till the deadline to do another for the next trading period or the next draft or whatever. Like, but now we've seen more trades after the draft, where, because it used to be like once you use that pick, let's say you were talking to Team X about player Y, and you were considering using your second round pick as currency. Once you use the pick and get a prospect, usually those talks have to start from scratch. But you know, we saw the Matheson trade after the draft. And I remember talking to Ken Hughes at the draft last year in Montreal and asking if the Jeff Petrie talks were in any way done or if they had to start over because of the fact that the draft was over. And he said, nope, none of the talks have involved anything that happened in this draft. And as it turns out, it wasn't. So we'll see. But I mean, if the Canadiens are hoping to get some more draft picks for this particular draft, then Josh Anderson's one, maybe the only way to do it, unless they decide to move Edmondson at that time, which is also possible.
Shifting gears here, the Canadiens have been, well, they played Sunday without Caden Gooley, who injured his right shoulder in the first period in Anaheim, stayed in the game, but clearly seemed bothered, and was not shooting comfortably. You could see him sometimes, you know, when guys will lift their hand just to say, hey, time for a change. Just signal to the bench the fact that they're ready for a change. And the movement just to lift his arm was just not there. And for now, he's day-to-day. So we'll see. He's day-to-day with an upper body injury.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Yeah, exactly.
What does day-to-day mean from this organization is really...
Ask Joel Edmondson. Hi, Joel Edmondson. Exactly. Oh, it's just a sidebar here. At the there's a reporter who asked Edmondson, says, how tough was it mentally to remain day by day, not knowing from one day to the next, you know, how you've been? It's because it lasted for so long. And he says, oh, well, there was a point where I was far from coming back.
Yeah.
So it was not day to day the whole time.
No.
Anyway. Exactly. Yeah. So Gooley,
but just to be specific here, the last player the Canadiens announced as being day to day was Joel Edmondson, and that was on January 27th. And so now we have Gooley and Barron as being day to day.
Right.
So just leave it at that. But sorry, go on.
Yeah. So the reason I bring it. Bring that topic on is because in the morning I spoke to Martin Saint-Louis and I asked him, because you know there's this hockey, longstanding hockey culture of you play despite the pain, you just bite the bullet, you go out there and you try to give your maximum to help the team win. And I asked him, well, where has the line need to be drawn between encouraging a player to go out there and go all out for the team and play despite the pain and send him out there again and factoring the risk that he might aggravate whatever he suffered earlier in the game. And he said, I don't know. He says, I'm not the one who's drawing that line. It's not my job to draw the line. I'm not with Graham Reinbend in between periods. Graham Reinbend, obviously, being the head therapist following the team. So he says, I don't know if the player is going to play, if he's going to be able to finish the game. I'm focusing on making adjustments on, you know, if we're winning, am I going to, or stay, if we're behind, am I going to change my lines or whatever? So I don't have time to focus on that. So coming back after the period, Graham is going to come to see me and he's going to give me the information as to if the guy is out or if the guy is in. And if he plays, I'll assume that he's okay. It's not about protecting the player. It's not about saying as if Graham would come to see me and say, hey, careful, that guy's at 60%. Either you play or you don't play. So we'll see how long Caden Gooley will be out. But there was clearly a risk in that game against Anaheim that he could have aggravated whatever he got to his shoulder. If it's nothing, if it didn't happen, fine, good on them. But the risk was there. And I don't know what you think about who needs to draw that line. Is it a philosophical decision by the organization? Does it have to be the head therapist? Is it the player himself who draws the line? How do you see that?
Well, the player can't draw the line, obviously, because the player will not draw the line. The player always wants to get back in the game, no matter how meaningless the game is. I mean, for crying out loud, Cole Caulfield wanted to play with his shoulder injury, and want to finish the season, you know? And so thankfully for him, he has a smart agent. The Canadians convince him otherwise. You know, argument could be made that should Caulfield have even played the games that he did play after suffering his injury? That's a legitimate question to ask, but at least the Canadians, his agent, the doctors involved, the specialists that they got involved, convinced him that it's not worth it. And so, but that's just an example of where if you leave it in a player's hands, they'll make some stupid decisions, you know? So you can't leave it in the player's hands, because players are wired differently than the rest of us. So I think Marty's viewpoint is actually a good one to take as a coach. It's not up to the coach to tell the person with actual medical training, well, you know what, I think this guy, let's not risk it with him. You know, that is the way he kind of spelled it out, is kind of how it should be, you know, like where the coach, and it kind of has been for a while, where the coach is informed that this player is playing. So you can't then be like, okay, well, is he playing? Like, can he kind of play? Like, should I, you know, like, what do you, like, how do you, you can't really protect players in a hockey game. You know, there are ways in other sports that you can sort of use players situationally. And I guess you could in the place, you know, if a player can shoot, but he's got, you know, an ankle issue or a knee issue or something, but he can go out and help you on the power play and but not really engage in puck battles and stuff like that, then yeah, I guess there's a way. But, you know, I think there has to be a line drawn from management, but that comes in discussions with your medical staff and your training staff, so that in the game situation, like, you can't have the GM calling Graham Reinbeck during a game and being like, we're taking this guy out, we're taking that guy in. He's got to be able to make a call based on how they're feeling, his assessment of the injury. But, you know, when you see Caden Gooley miss a game after being allowed to finish the game prior.
Yeah.
And let's be clear. I mean, if Caden Gooley hurts his shoulder in game 4 of the Stanley Cup final, and the series is 2-1, and he wants to come back, well, that's a different conversation than, you know, playing on whatever it was, March 3rd, on the day of the trade deadline in Anaheim, in a completely nothing game. You've already missed 2 months of action with a knee injury. You are the young jewel of the Canadiens' defense. That's also probably a different conversation than if, say, Alex Belzile were hurt and wanted to come back, you know? So there's a lot of nuance there, but I mean, I think it's definitely, I would agree with Marty that it's not his call, but I think the Canadians need to do a better job of nailing that nuance, right? Let's look at, you know, coaches always talk about manage the game. Manage the score, manage the scoreboard, manage the clock, manage everything. And so I think some of that has to happen with these injuries, right? Like, when I saw Caden Gooley come back, I'm like, he better be healthy and he better play the next game, because this would be a bad look. If he comes back into this game and misses the next game, that's not good. But they did do that with Justin Barron in the previous game. I think cameras caught Barron trying to talk his way into staying. And I think Graham actually seemed to at least insist on him leaving the game, getting examined. And then I guess he probably convinced him that he shouldn't be playing. So it's not as if those decisions aren't
not,
being
if
made.
Not, it's the spotter who took him out of the game.
Yeah, it could have been, but might have been. I mean, but in any case, I have a real issue with Caden Gooley finishing that game at Anaheim. Is all I'm saying. That's, to me, that's something that the Canadians need to clean up.
Yeah. Because, yeah, I think it is a delicate, you know, balance to find, because on the one hand, I don't think that they've got sometimes the equipment or the time necessary to understand the extent of an injury in between two periods. So they might not be able to really realize what they're going to, what they're exposing the player to if he goes back out there. And I guess the other part of it is if you start to pull out players every time that there's a sting or something that that might look painful at first, but eventually can resolve itself, you might start pulling out a lot of guys. So it's just, that's why it's a balancing act that's hard to find. But I agree with you on the fact that they need to maybe fine tune that procedure and come to an understanding of how they're going to approach it. Because I mean, when I saw Max Jones like delivering like a solid hit on Gouley in the second period, mm-hmm. or was it early in the third? And I mean, it really tested his shoulder back then. And I thought, meh, for a guy who's already hurt, and after that on the power play, he could not shoot. He had situations where he could easily have placed himself in a position to shoot, and systematically, every time the puck came back to the point, he would pass it, and not even, you know, disguise a shot or fake a shot or whatever, suggest that he might shot. So I don't know. There's no clear cut answer, and obviously from the press box for us, it's easy to call out, but there. There's also the whole culture of hockey that comes into play, and just to tough it up, fine. But these guys are investments, and these guys are the future of that team, especially when you talk about a guy like Gouley. So that you have to go with what's going to be the most beneficial for your team in the longer run.
And here's the thing that I find curious is that I've heard from a few people that there's like, I wouldn't characterize it as frustration, but that there is some questioning going on of how the Canadiens medical staff and training staff are overly conservative when it comes to return to play, and how they will strictly adhere to a protocol and they will not allow a player to come back from an injury too soon. And that's something that they really stick to, and that, you know, some members of the coaching staff have questioned, some members of management have questioned that, are we really overdoing it with some of these guys? And so for the same staff to be kind of somewhat brazen in, you know, I mean, Cole Caulfield returned to the game. Well, he never left the game the first time he injured his shoulder. The second time he injured his shoulder, he did leave the game and was in quite a bit of pain, returned to that game. That was January 3rd in Nashville. We had Gouley the other night. We've had many instances of players getting injured, leaving the game, returning to the game, and then being...
Gallagher made a career out of that.
Yes, exactly. But I mean, just the season alone is what I'm talking about. Like, I mean, just... players returning to a game and then all after we find out they're actually injured and they're going to be out for a while, you know? So it's, I think that's one area where, and again, situations dictate sometimes illogical or irresponsible decisions. You know, I mean, Patrice Bergeron played in the Stanley Cup final with a punctured lung. Like,
yeah,
no one would recommend doing that, but it's the Stanley Cup final and you're that close to, and you know, Carey Price and Shea Weber played on debilitating injuries that ended their careers in the Stanley Cup final and throughout the Stanley Cup playoffs for all we know. And so
Bob Gaine, 86.
There's a long, long list of players doing this in the playoffs, or if you're doing it in the midst of a playoff chase, if you're trying to get in games that matter, I get it. You know, this is what athletes do. It's not only hockey players, people do it in all sports. When the games matter, I can understand there's a risk reward assessment that needs to be made, right? This is the risk. This is the potential reward. Well, the reward here is zero. There's no reward. If Gouley comes back and leads this miraculous comeback and the Canadiens beat the Ducks, who cares? There's no reward. The reward's not non-existent. So that risk reward calculation for a game on March 3rd in Anaheim, to me, should never result in the player returning back to the game. It shouldn't. And yeah. It's just, you know, it just keeps happening. So anyhow, this is something that, you know, just to be clear, it's been made clear to us that the Canadians are already reviewing all of their medical practices, whether they are any worse than any other team at this. And I am convinced that in the offseason, there's going to be a deeper review of everything the Canadians do from a medical standpoint. And I would not be surprised to see some changes, adjustments. I don't want to suggest people are going to get fired or replaced or whatever. I have no idea about that, but they're definitely going to look at the way they do things. And if adjustments need to be made, if corrections need to be made, and if changes need to be made, I think that's going to happen. Cause for this regime, their initial priority was to deal with hockey operations and everything that goes on there. And I think now they're seeing to what extent they need to look at that side, that department of this organization, and really take a deep look at it and ask some difficult questions.
Okay, last topic, Arpin. Let's look towards the future. The Canadians are coming back to the Bell Center. They're starting a month of March that will be extremely busy for them. Crazy schedule coming up. They're going to start on Tuesday against Carolina. Then they're going to have the Rangers coming up and the New Jersey Devils. So quite a week at the Bell Center.
Don't stop there. I mean,
fine. Well, you know, there's Colorado after that, so that's the 4-game homestand. And then they leave. They're going to leave to Pittsburgh and then Florida. Pittsburgh, I don't know what to make of them right now. That's a team that was hard to read at the trade deadline, but they're always make for tough opponents whenever the Canadians go play there. Florida's fighting for their lives. Tampa is going to be an interesting case by this time, you know, in 10 days from now. We'll see how much of a contender they still are, or if have they been broken by something.
No, they're reeling. They're reeling right now. They're in a bad. Yeah. They're in a bad place right now. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. That's also the night that Martin St. Louis and Vincent Lecavalier will be inducted into the Lightning Hall of Fame. The brand new Tampa Bay Lightning Hall of Fame on the 18th.
So two games against the Tampa Bay Lightning, because there's one in Montreal too. Then Boston. I mean, it doesn't stop. So this murderer's row, when you compare it to, because we started that discussion, you mentioned the other teams that are around the Canadians in the standings that didn't necessarily get a lot worse at the trade deadline, but their schedule is more favorable than the Canadians. I mean,
I mean, if you look at the standings, you know, right now, like the Canadians have six teams below them in the standings. Five of them are in the Western Conference. The only one that's not is Columbus, who's dead last. The reality is that that means that those five teams are going to play other Western Conference teams, by and large. The Canadians, their last Western Conference team is Colorado on Monday.
Yeah, you said Columbus, but you meant Colorado.
No. When I said Columbus is the only non-Western team below the Canadians in the standings.
Okay, yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And so... So you look at Vancouver's a point back, Arizona's 4 points back, Anaheim's 6 points back, even San Jose's 8 points back. Now you would think that seems insurmountable, but you listen. Marc-Antoine just went through the schedule. Okay, the schedule is not. They've already lost three in a row. It's not very difficult to see a reality where they wind up losing six, seven in a row. Like it's right there. You know, but you know, in the notebook this morning, you can read it on The Athletic. But I mean, we went through the Canuck schedule, the Coyote schedule, the Duck schedule. Didn't really go into the San Jose schedule, but each of them have a number of games that I could see them winning, that are winnable. You know, that are definitely, and the Canadians just don't have those, so. this kind of ties it all back to the people who are freaking out about the deadline. There's probably the same people who have been freaking out about the Canadiens winning too many games and getting too high in the standings. I mean, as it is now, if the lottery were held today, the Canadiens would have the 7th best odds. 7th and 12th, if I'm not mistaken.
13th. 7th, that's pretty much where they've stood for a while now.
Yeah, and I think I'm of the mind that so the Canucks are going to pass them, I think. Just the way and you look at the Canucks schedule, it's they're going to pass them. So it really comes down to Arizona and Anaheim. Because the Canadiens are 3 points behind the Flyers right now. So, and the Blues. So considering the schedule we just described, I don't like their chances of passing those teams.
Mm-hmm.
I think Vancouver has a very good chance of winding up ahead of Montreal based on the schedules coming up. The real interesting ones are Arizona and Anaheim. Anaheim's won 4 or 5 games. Just saying. Like they're on a bit of a run. They have the Canucks twice in their next 7, no, in their next 8 games. They play the Canucks twice. They got Calgary twice. Calgary's a bit of a mess. They got Columbus once. They got Nashville. It's looking pretty decent as far as the Ducks and the Coyotes, who don't have quite as easy a schedule, but still St. Louis, Nashville, Calgary, Vancouver, Chicago in the next couple of weeks. I don't think it's that inconceivable that by the time the Canadiens finish that stretch you just mentioned, so somewhere around March 24th, that the Canadiens find themselves 28th, 29th even. Like it's not inconceivable. But 28th is that Arizona spot to me seems attainable. Now, the Canadiens obviously have to cooperate and lose to these teams, but they're going to win some of those games that we just described, obviously. But yeah, it's not looking so bad for them to get into the top 5. And if they can get to the top 4 in this draft, that's a game changer. Like if they wind up with the 4th pick instead of the 5th, then they're into the... Then they're into a different tier of player in the draft.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, ideally you'd like to stay in the top 5. Top 4 would be awesome. That's really where it goes. But yeah, otherwise you fall. I mean, when you look at the Arizona spot at 28, they have that spot holds an 8.5% chance of getting the first pick overall and an 8.8 chance of the second pick overall. So it's not that much better than Montreal, what Montreal currently has. You're talking roughly, if you combine the two, 4% chance difference. Mm-hmm. So it's not that big, but I mean, hey, any odds would be welcome at this point.
Well, and also you just have to look at the odds of just staying where you are, which is the difference between 4 and 5, even though the whole Michkov thing might make that kind of moot because who knows where he's going to go. But, you know, all things being equal, if there was no baggage attached to the whole Michkov situation, then that top 4 is really important as opposed to 5. But yeah, we'll have to find out. It's also worth looking. Like the Panthers, I really don't like their chances of making the playoffs. They're in a bit of a tough spot. And that second first round pick, I mean, they have a game in hand on the Islanders, but they're 4 points behind the Islanders. And the Penguins have 2 games in hand on them. The Sabres have 3 games in hand on them. And the Sens have 2 games in hand on them. And I mean, to perfectly illustrate the Panthers situation is that they have the exact same record as the Washington Capitals right now. And the Capitals just decide to sell off pieces. Like they just kind of, they just like, we're out. We're not. And so the Panthers obviously can't do that because they've already kind of invested this pick. And so the Canadians are not in a bad situation, I think, is the point that I want to make. And it's actually a good way to end the podcast because the people were freaking out about the trade deadline. There's reasons not to. And the key people are freaking out about the draft lottery. It's highly likely that the Canadians are going to be the only team with two lottery picks. Other than Detroit, because Vancouver, for some reason, traded them the Islanders pick. So the Islanders, if they drop out, Detroit could wind up with two lottery picks. But the Canadians are probably going to be the only team with two lottery picks.
Plus the Panthers. I mean, they've been on sort of a push to try to get themselves out of a hole. But that push, they would need a second push now to go further and leapfrog the teams that are in front of them. So good luck with that.
Well, especially not only that, with this push, they haven't won or lost consecutive games since February 9th.
Mm-hmm.
They've spent a month of alternating wins and losses. That's not going to get it done. Like, they need to go on a run, and it's just not happening. Like, it's they've been better maybe, I guess, since the start of the new year, but you know, they had one 3-game win streak where they beat Boston and Tampa and San Jose. And so other than that, since February 9th, since that win against San Jose, which was their third straight, they have ping-ponged between wins and losses every second game. Like, every game has been... So I don't see a scenario in which they can leapfrog these teams, like Buffalo surging, Ottawa's red hot, you know, like just completely. I mean, what a great situation for them, but it makes it that much harder for Florida.
It's great.
They're one of the hottest teams in the league right now. And Pittsburgh is what they are. Like, it's just, I don't like the Florida Panthers' chances of getting into the playoffs, is all my point is. And so, like, if you're freaking out about the fact that the Canadiens' draft odds are not good enough, you might want, the Canadiens' draft odds have a very good chance of improving this month, and B, they are in all likelihood going to be the only team with two lottery picks in this draft. Unless the Islanders don't make the playoffs, in which case you could add the Red Wings to that group. But there's also the scenario where the Senators don't make the playoffs, which I'm gonna gamble that they might not. No, so if the Senators don't make the playoffs, then the Coyotes would also have two lottery picks. So those are the scenarios. And that's not a bad place, you know, and the Canes, you know, if they wind up with the fifth pick overall, or the 6th and the 12th, they're not in a bad spot.
Well, we'll see how they fare this coming week. It all starts there. All right, Arpin. So thanks for, as usual, thanks for your contribution. This podcast is a lot of fun. I like doing it twice a week. I think it works well.
I like doing it twice a week, too. I think it allows the people who only listen to us in one language to at least have one episode every week. And, but yeah, you'll be traveling when people are listening to this podcast, you'll be on your way back to Montreal after an epic journey. So I'll be glad to see you at some point. I can give you your car back.
Yes.
That would be good. Yeah,
I know.
And, but otherwise, just a little reminder about, you know, helping people find the podcast. If you do listen to us, whatever platform you listen to us on, whether that's Apple Podcasts or Spotify or anything else, if you drop a rating, preferably a good one, if you don't mind, and a comment, it does help people find the podcast. So that would be greatly appreciated. And also, if you have not yet subscribed to The Athletic, I would just like to remind you that our listeners always have a discount on their first year at theathletic.com/athletic support. That is theathletic.com/athletic support to read not only Marc Antoine and I, but all of our wonderful writers across the NHL, across all of the professional sports landscape around the world. We just launched our F1 vertical with the start of the F1 season. That's really exciting. So please check that out as well.
Okay. And one last public service announcement on my end. Guys, you can send us your questions by just calling our voicemail. You drop a message, and we'll be more than happy to discuss those comments, those questions that you send us. So you can do so by calling 646-847-9404. I nailed it this time.
I was so proud of you. I was like, oh my God, is he going to get through it? Is he going to get through the number?
646-847-9404. I know my numbers. Thank you so much, everybody. And we'll talk to you on Friday for the Spot, Litzy. Bye-bye.